The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Lisa Zeidner from Rutgers University in Camden, and I'm delighted to be introducing Laurie Moore today. She is, as probably all of you know, the author of 4 books of short stories, most recently Birds of America. Does this sound okay to you? It has a weird sibilance up here, Andy, but okay. And 2 previous novels, Anagrams and Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, which is incidentally as wonderful as its title. She has received the Ray Award for the short story and the Irish Times International Fiction Prize, among many other honors. Those of us who have been waiting a long time for a new Laurie Moore book to savor are in a kind of special club. It's not as if she's been in hiding like Thomas Pynchon waiting to spring some tome on us, although, let's face it, Pynchon is not that much in hiding. You can hang out with him at his kids' baseball games on the Upper West Side. Laurie Moore is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, and now that you mention it, has also put in some serious hours on the fields at her own kids' sporting events. I mention this because parenthood, its thorny complexities, its life-changing heartbreaks, is so much at the center of her astonishing new novel, A Gate at the Stairs. The novel concerns a 20-year-old Midwestern college student, Tassie, who takes a part-time job as a nanny to an adopted mixed-race baby in the year right after 9/11. The strange family whose life she enters educates her about the world, as does her sexual awakening during that same year, far more than her university classes, which happen to include introduction to Sufism, introduction to wine tasting, soundtracks to war movies, and a geology course called Dating Rocks. Laurie Moore is, first and foremost, funny. She is profoundly funny, by which I mean she uses humor to plumb the depths and can find the gallow humor in the most dire situations, even as we learned from her last collection of stories in the pediatric oncology ward of a hospital. Laurie Moore can be funny about an infant having chemotherapy. What's most distinctive about her work is the voice of her sometimes brittle, sometimes vulnerable, idiosyncratic, wise-cracking characters. Those characters are often women. If I can be permitted a millisecond of feminism, don't let the fact that they're women distract you from their philosophical depths or ferocious intelligence. Think Dorothy Parker crossbred with, say, Kierkegaard. Or, as Tassie puts it about her own keenly observing self, I had always felt as hidden as the hull in a berry, as secret and fetal as the curled fortune in a cookie, and such hiddenness was not without its advantages, its egotisms, its grief-fed grandiosities. Often, her characters don't feel like they fit in. They feel stranded and outcast in the cancer ward, or as New Yorkers in the cheerful Midwest, or as single women at their married friends' parties, or as African-American kids in predominantly white schools. You can make an argument, in fact, that not belonging and the struggle for identity is the theme of every great American novel from Gatsby to Portrait of a Lady. It certainly is a central theme of A Gate at the Stairs, where no one is quite sure what he is or what he should be. Tassie's father should not be a farmer. Her brother should not be in Iraq. Her boyfriend should maybe go back to Brazil, where he may or may not be from. In plumbing Tassie's coming of age, Laurie Moore also gives us an original, exacting portrait of what it means to be an American in this particular moment of history. Please join me in welcoming Laurie Moore.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Lisa, for that lovely introduction. I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of this novel. It's sort of put together a little, the reading is put together a little bit in patches, but I think there's a through line that carries us through a number of events, and then I'll stop, and then I'll take your questions. Okay. The narrator is a woman in her late 20s who's looking back at the year that she turned 20. Excuse me, that year she was 20 and turned 21. And she, during that time, is looking for a job. And that's where this particular portion of the novel begins. She's in college and is looking for babysitting work. And so I needed a job. I had donated my plasma several times for cash. But the last time I had tried, the clinic had turned me away, saying my plasma was cloudy from having eaten cheese the night before. Cloudy plasma. I would be the bass guitarist. It was so hard not to eat cheese. Even the whipped and spreadable kind we derisively called cram cheese, because it could be used for sealing windows and caulking tile, had a certain soothing allure. I looked daily at the employment listings. Child care was in demand. I turned in my final papers and answered the ads. One 40-ish pregnant woman after another hung up my coat, sat me in her living room, then waddled out to the kitchen, got my tea, and waddled back in, clutching her back, slopping tea onto the saucer, and asking me questions. What would you do if our little baby started crying and wouldn't stop? Are you available evenings? What do you think of as a useful educational activity for a small child? I had no idea. I had never seen so many pregnant women in such a short period of time, 5 in all. It alarmed me. They did not look radiant. They looked reddened with high blood pressure and frightened. I would put him in a stroller and take him for a walk, I said. I knew my own mother had never asked such questions of anyone. Dolly, she said to me once, as long as the place was moderately fire resistant, I'd deposit you anywhere. Will you be in town for Christmas break? The mother's now asked. I sipped at the tea. No, I'm going home, but I will be back in January. When in January? I gave them my references and a written summary of my experience. My experience was not all that much, just the Pitskys and the Schultzes back home. But as experience, too, I had once, as part of a class project on human reproduction, carried around for an entire week a sack of flour, the exact weight and feel of an infant. I'd swaddled it and cuddled it and placed it in safe, cushioned places for naps, but once, when no one was looking, I stuffed it in my backpack with a lot of sharp pens. And it got stabbed. My books, powdery white, the rest of the term became a joke in class. I left this off my resume, however. But the rest I'd typed up to gild the lily-livered, as my father sometimes said, as I was wearing what the department stores called a career jacket. And perhaps the women liked the professionalism of that. They were professionals themselves. Two were lawyers, one was a journalist, one was a doctor, one a high school teacher. Where were the husbands? Oh, at work, the women all said vaguely, all except the journalist, who said, good question. The last house was a gray stucco prairie house with a chimney cloaked in dead ivy. I had passed the house earlier in the week. It was on a corner lot, and I'd seen so many birds there. Now there was just a flat expanse of white. Around the whiteness was a low wood qualine fence, and when I pushed open its gate, it slipped a little. One of its hinges was loose and missing a nail. I had to lift the gate to relatch it. This maneuver, one I'd performed any number of times in my life, gave me a certain satisfaction of tidiness, of restoration, of magic me, when in fact it should have communicated itself as something else. Someone's ill-disguised decrepitude, items not cared for properly but fixed repeatedly in a make-do fashion, needful things having gotten away from their caregiver. Soon the entire gate would have to be held together with a bungee cord the way my father once fixed a door in our barn. Two slate steps led, in an odd mismatch of rock, downward to a flagstone walk, all of which, as well as the grass, wore a light dusting of snow. I laid the first footprints of the day. Perhaps the front door was seldom used. Some desiccated mums were still in pots on the porch. Ice frosted the crisp heads of the flowers. Leaning against the house were a shovel and a rake, and shoved into the corner, two phone books still in shrink wrap. The woman of the house opened the door. She was pale and compact, no sags or pouches, linen skin tight across the bone. The hollows of her cheeks were powdered darkly, as if with the pollen of a tiger lily. Her hair was cropped short and dyed the fashionable bright auburn of a ladybug. Her earrings were buttons of deepest orange, her leggings mahogany, her sweater rust-colored, and her lips maroonish brown. She looked like a highly controlled oxidation experiment. "Come in," she said, and I entered mutely at first, and then, as always, apologetically, as if I were late, though I wasn't. At that time in my life, I was never late. Only a year later would I suddenly have difficulty hanging on to any sense of time, leaving friends sitting invariably for a half hour here or there. Time would waft past me undetectably or absurdly, laughably when I could laugh, in quantities I was incapable of measuring or obeying. But that year, when I was 20, I was punctual as a priest. Were priests punctual? I believed that they were. The woman closed the heavy oak door behind me, and I stamped my feet on the braided rug I was standing on to shake off the snow. I started then to take off my shoes. "Oh, you don't have to take off your shoes," she said. "There's too much of that prissy Japanese stuff going on in this town. Bring in the mud." She smiled, big, theatrical, a little crazy. I'd forgotten her name and was hoping she'd say it soon. If she didn't, she might not say it at all. "I'm Tassie Kelchin," I said, thrusting out my hand. She took it and then studied my face. "Yes," she said slowly, absently, unnervingly scrutinizing each of my eyes. Her gaze made a slow, observing circle around my nose and mouth. "I'm Sarah Brink," she said finally. I was not used to being looked at close up, not used to the thing I was looking at looking back. Certainly my own mother had never done such looking, and in general my face had the kind of smooth, round stupidity that did not prompt the world's study. I had always felt as hidden as the hull in a berry, as secret and fetal as the curled fortune in a cookie, and such hiddenness was not without its advantages, its egotisms, its grief-fed grandiosities. That you heard in the introduction from Lee Sibso. There it is again. Thank you. "Here, let me take your coat," Sarah Brink said finally. And only then, as she lifted it off me and headed across the foyer to hang it on a hat rack, did I see that she was thin as a pin, not pregnant at all. She led me into the living room, stopping at the large back window first. I followed her, tried to do what she did. In the yard, most of a large oak tree split by lightning had been hacked and stacked by the garage for winter firewood. Near its old stump, another tree, tenuous, young, with the look of a swizzle stick, had been planted, trussed, and braced. But Sarah was not studying the trees. "Oh, for the love of God, look at these poor dogs," she said. We stood there watching. The dogs next door were being kept in the yard by an invisible electric fence. One of them, a German shepherd, understood the fence. But the other one, a little terrier, did not. The German shepherd would get a game of chase going around the yard and lead the terrier right to the electrified border and then stop short, leaving the terrier to barrel on ahead into the electricity. The stunned terrier would then come racing back, shrieking with pain. This amused the German shepherd, who continued to do this, and the shocked terrier, desperate for play, would forget and get started again, and barrel on into the electricity again, yowling. "This has been going on for weeks," said Sarah. "Reminds me of dating," I said. And Sarah spun her head to size me up again. I could see now that she was at least 2 inches taller than I was. I could peer up her nostrils, the weave of tiny hairs like crisscrosses of branches seen from the base of a tree. She smiled, which pushed her cheeks out and made the blush beneath them look shadowy and wrong. Heat flew to my face. Dating, what did I know of dating? My roommate Murph had done all the dating and had essentially abandoned me so that she could now sleep every night with this new guy she'd met. She had bequeathed me her vibrator, a strange, swirling, buzzing thing that, when switched to high, gyrated in the air like someone's bored, thick finger going whoop-de-doo. Whose penis could this possibly resemble? Someone who had worked in a circus, perhaps. Maybe Burt Lancaster's in trapeze. I kept the thing on the kitchen counter where Murph had left it for me, and occasionally I used it to stir my chocolate milk. I sat down on a small sofa that was upholstered in a kind of pillow ticking. Child care, like health care, had become one word. I would become a dispenser of it. I opened my backpack and began fumbling through it, looking for a copy of my resume. Sarah sat across from me on another pillow-ticking sofa, the very brightness of her looking as if it might stain the cushions. She twisted her legs up and around each other in such a way that the lower half of one gave the illusion of jutting out of the upper half of the other, as if she had the backwards knees of a crane. She began clearing her throat, so I stopped fumbling and set the backpack aside. "Already the winter air is getting to me," she said. She turned and coughed again loudly in that parched fashion that doctors called unproductive. She patted her flat stomach. "Here's the deal," she said again. "We are adopting." "Adopting?" "A baby. We are adopting a baby in 2 weeks. That's why we're advertising for a sitter. We'd like to line someone up ahead of time for regular hours." I didn't know anything about adoption. I'd known only one adopted girl when I was growing up, Bessie Susluck, spoiled and beautiful, and at 16, having an affair with a must and handsome student teacher that I myself had a crush on. In general, I thought of adoption much as I thought of most things in life, uneasily. "Congratulations," I murmured now to Sarah. "Was that what one said?" Sarah's face lit up gratefully, as if no one had yet said an encouraging word to her on the matter. "Why, thank you. I have so much work at the restaurant that everyone I mention this to acts peculiar and quiet, so meanly worried for me. They say, 'Really?' And then all this tension springs to their mouth. They think I'm too old." I accidentally nodded. I had no idea, conversationally, where we were. I searched, as I too often found myself having to do, to find a language or even an octave in which to speak. I wondered how old she was. "I own Le Petit Moulin," Sarah Brink added. Le Petit Moulin. I knew of it a little. It was one of those expensive restaurants downtown, every entree freshly hairy with dill, every soup and dessert dripped upon as preciously as a pollock. Filets and cutlets sprinkled with lavender dust once owned by pixies. Restaurants to which students never went except if newly pinned to a fraternity boy or dating an assistant dean or hosting a visit from their concerned suburban parents. I knew Le Petit Moulin served things that sounded like instruments, timbales, quenelles. God only knew what they were. I had once tried to study the menu in the lit window near the entrance, and as I stared at the words, the sting of my own exile had moistened my eyes. Now Sarah Brink laughed, a quasi-laugh, a socially constructed laugh, a collection of predetermined notes like the chimes of a doorbell. "So here's the job description," she said when the laugh was through. Walking home, I passed a squirrel that had been hit by a car. Its soft scarlet guts spilled out of its mouth as if in a dialogue balloon, and the wind gently blew the fur of its tail as if it were still alive. I tried to remember everything Sarah Brink had said to me. It was a mile home to my apartment, so I replayed long snippets of her voice, though the cold air was the sort that bullied a walker into mental muteness. I tried to think of who Sarah Brink reminded me of, though I was sure it wasn't anyone I'd actually met. Probably she reminded me of a character from a television show I'd watched years before, but not the star. Definitely not the star. More like the star's neatnik roommate or the star's kooky cousin from Cleveland. I knew, even once she had a baby, she would never be able to shake the anti-mame quality from her mothering. There were worse things, I supposed. In the morning, I woke up in a blaze of white sun. The phone rang before I'd had time to let the coffee I'd made kick in and give me words to say. Nonetheless, I picked up the receiver. "Hi, is this Tassie?" said the newly familiar voice. "Yes, it is." I frantically gulped at my coffee. What time was it? Too soon for calls. "This is Sarah Brink. Did I wake you up? I'm sorry, I'm calling too early, aren't I?" "Oh, no," I said, lest she think I was a shiftless bum. Better a lying sack of shit. I didn't know whether I'd left a message on the correct machine or not, she said, and I wanted to get back to you as soon as possible before you accepted an offer from someone else. Little did she know. "I've talked it over with my husband, and we'd like to offer you the job." Could she even have called the references I'd listed? Had there been enough time to? "Oh, thank you," I said. "We'll start you at $10 an hour with the possibility of raises down the line," she said. "Okay," I sipped at the coffee, trying to wake my brain. "Let the coffee speak." "The problem is this," she said. "The job starts today." "Today?" I sipped again. "Yes, I'm sorry. We're going to Kronenkey to meet the birth mother, and we'd like you to come with us." "Yes, well, I think that would be okay." "So you accept the position?" "Yes, I guess I do." "You do? You can't know how happy you've made me." "Really?" I asked, all the while wondering. Where's the new employee's first day orientation meeting? Where is the "you've picked a great place to work" PowerPoint presentation? The coffee was kicking in, but not helpfully. "Oh, yes, really," she said. "Can you be here by noon?" The appointment with the birth mother was for 2 p.m. at the Perkins restaurant in Kronenkey, a town an hour away with a part German, part Indian name that I'd always assumed meant wampum. The social worker who ran the adoption agency was supposed to meet us there with the birth mother, and everyone would cheerfully assess one another. I had walked the half hour to Sarah Brink's house and then waited 20 minutes while she scrambled around doing things, making quick phone calls to the restaurant or searching madly for her sunglasses. "I hate that snow glare on the two-lane road," she'd said, all the while apologizing to me from the next room. In the car, on our way up, I sat next to her in the front seat since her husband, Edward, whom strangely I still hadn't met, couldn't get out of some meeting or other and had apparently told Sarah to go ahead without him. "Marriage," sighed Sarah, as if I had any idea what that meant. Yet it did seem odd that he wasn't with her, and odder still that I seemed to be going in his stead. But I nodded. "He must be busy," I said, giving Edward the benefit of the doubt, though I was beginning to think Edward might be, well, an asshole. I looked sideways at Sarah, who was hatless with a long cranberry scarf coiled twice about her neck. The sun caught the shiny artifice of her hair as well as the stray tufts of white lint on her peacoat. Still, especially with the sunglasses in winter, something I had seldom seen before, she looked glamorous. I was not especially used to speaking to adults, so I felt comfortable just being quiet with her. And soon she turned on the classical music station, and we listened to Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition and Night on Bald Mountain for the entire ride. "They've told me the birth mother's very beautiful," said Sarah at one point, and I said nothing, not knowing what to say. We waited in the second booth in at Perkins, Sarah and I sitting on the same side to leave the seat open opposite fully, to leave the seat opposite fully open for the two people we were waiting for. Sarah ordered coffee for us both, and I sat looking over the plasticized Perkins menu, with its little pictures of golden French fries laid out on frilly, verdant lettuce next to tomato slices the size of small clocks. What would I order? There was the bread bowl salad, the Heartland omelet, and various bottomless beverages for the greedy and thirsty. I feared I was both. Sarah ordered Perkins's bottomless pot of coffee for the entire table, and the waitress went away to bring it. "Oh, look, there they are," murmured Sarah, and I looked up to see a heavily made-up middle-aged woman in a deep pink parka, holding the arm of a girl, probably my age, maybe younger, who was very pregnant, very pretty, and when she smiled at us, even from that distance, I could see she had scarcely a tooth in her head. We stood and moved toward them. The girl wore an electronic bracelet on her wrist, but was clearly unembarrassed by this because she energetically thrust her hand out from her sleeve in greeting. I shook it. "Hi," she said to me. I wondered what she had done and why the bracelet was not around her ankle instead. Perhaps she had been very, very bad and had both. "Hi," I replied, trying to smile companionably and not stare at her stomach. "This is the mother here," the woman in the pink parka told the pregnant girl, indicating Sarah. "Sarah Brink, Amber Bowers." "Hi, it's so wonderful to meet you." Sarah grasped Amber's hand warmly and shook it for too long. Amber kept turning back hopefully toward me as if she were as baffled as I was to be in the company of these mysterious middle-aged women. "I'm Tassie Kelchin," I said quickly, shaking Amber's penalized hand yet again. The delicate knobs of her wrists and her elegant fingers were in strong contrast to her toothlessness and the hard plastic parole band. "I'm going to work for Sarah," I said, "as a child care provider." "And I'm Letitia Gerlich," said the adoption agency woman, shaking my hand, though not letting go of Amber's coat sleeve, as if she might escape. Amber did have the face, if not currently the body, of someone who perhaps more than once had suddenly made a run for it. "Hey, Letitia," said Sarah, who threw her arms around her as if they were old friends. The Letitia stiffened a little. "Here, come sit down," she said. "The waitress is bringing coffee." After that, things moved with swiftness and awkwardness both, like something simultaneously strong and broken. We hung up coats, we ordered, we ate, we made chit-chat about the food and the snow. "Oh, there's my probation officer," Amber said, giggling. Her face brightened as if she had a little crush on him. "I think he sees us. He's sitting right over there by the window." We looked up to see the probation officer, his blue jacket still on, his bottomless Diet Coke stacked with ice, a going-to-seed hunk and a windbreaker. The world seemed full of them. We all just stared to buy ourselves time, I suppose, and to avoid the actual question of Amber's crimes. Letitia began to speak to Sarah on Amber's behalf. "Amber is happy to meet Tassie as well as you, Sarah." Here Amber looked across at me and rolled her eyes as if we were two girls out with our embarrassing mothers. I'd been noticing Amber's face, which was as lovely as advertised, but sassy, with a strange electricity animating it, and with the missing teeth she seemed like a slightly educated hillbilly or an infant freak. Her hair was gingery blonde, shoulder length, as straight and coarse as a horse's tail. "Amber's wondering, of course, about your religious plans for the baby. She's very interested in having the baby baptized Catholic, aren't you, Amber?" "Oh, yeah," said Amber. "That's the whole point of this." She pulled out the front of her bulgy, stretchy sweater and let it snap back. "And, of course, she would hope you would have the child confirmed as well when the time came." "We could do that. We could definitely do that," Sarah said agreeably. "Were you raised Catholic?" asked Amber. Well, no, but my cousins were," said Sarah, as if this solved everything. Letitia, nervous about the sticky parts of a deal, said cheerily, "The birth father is white. I did mention that to you, didn't I?" Sarah said nothing, her face momentarily inscrutable. She picked up a lone, cold French fry the waitress had yet to clear and began to chew. Letitia continued, "Tall and good-looking, like Amber." Amber smiled happily. "We broke up," she said, shrugging. do have a picture of him to show Sarah. Letitia was selling the idea of the handsome white boy dad. I don't think I ever had a damn picture of him, said Amber, shaking her head. Now she looked at me, grinning. Except in my mind. My mind's a regular exhibition. The phrase was oddly reminiscent of the Mussorgsky we just listened to in the car. And Amber's mouth, with its few and crooked teeth, bits of shell awash on a reef of gum, seemed a curious home for her voice, which was slowly surprising with its intelligence and humor. There was a lull now. Amber suddenly leaned back, physically uncomfortable. So where's your husband? She asked Sarah. I examined Sarah's face for the stiffened look of the accused. He's at a meeting his lab is having with the university. I run my own restaurant in town so I can make my own schedule as far as meetings go, but well, he's at the beck and call of others, at least today he is. Do you think you really have time for a baby owning a restaurant and all? Amber was not shy. If she had been shy, not one of us would be at Perkins right now. Sarah refused to be flustered. She'd heard remarks of this sort a dozen times, but before she could speak, Letitia spoke for her. That's why Tassie's here. Tassie's the backup. But Sarah will always be around. She'll be the mom. And she can do a lot of her work right out of the house. Isn't that right, Sarah? What work could Sarah do from the house? Absolutely, Sarah said. Oh, I forgot. I brought you a present, Amber. She took a CD from her purse. It's a mixed CD of my favorite classical music. Amber took it and stashed it in her bag with the most fleeting of glances. Perhaps she had a slew of these lunches and as a means of collecting goodies, which she would later sell on eBay. And I have a present for you, too, Amber said, and handed Sarah a foil-wrapped pat of butter she plucked from the bowl on the table. It's wrapped, she said, smiling wickedly. The CD hadn't been. A scalding boldness gripped Amber's face, then a kind of guilt, then drifty blankness, like songs of a jukebox flipped through unchosen. Thanks, said Sarah gamely. You had to hand it to her. She opened up the butter and applied it to her mouth like lip gloss. Prevents chapped lips, she said. You're welcome, said Amber. When we all walked out to the parking lot, the probation officer followed. The American flag was flapping noisily next to the Perkins sign. The air was picking up wind and snow. The probation officer walked to his car and got in, but did not start it. Amber's face was completely lit up. I saw that she was fantastically in love with him. She was not concentrating on any of us, and something about this provoked Sarah. Well, she said, studying Amber with an artificial smile. Yes, well, said Amber. All right, then, said Letitia. Can I give you some advice, Amber? Sarah asked, standing there as Letitia clutched Amber even tighter. Letitia was ecstatic to have a white birth mother in tow, one with a little white bun in the oven, and did not want a rival agency to get a hold of her. Or so Sarah would say later. The windbreakered parole officer gave a wave and drove off. What? Amber said to Sarah. But to me she smiled and said, he was definitely following me. When I was your age, I had some rebellious ideas, Sarah continued her unsolicited advice to Amber. I got in trouble now and again, here and there, but I realized it was because I was doing things I wasn't any good at. Look at this. She tapped Amber's electronic bracelet with a gloved index finger. You're 18. Don't sell drugs. You're no good at it. Do something you're good at. Sarah meant this tough love speech compassionately, I could see. But Amber's face flushed with insult, then hardened. That's what I'm trying to do, she said indignantly, and tore herself from Letitia's grip, walked over to what was apparently Letitia's car, and got in on the passenger side. We'll talk later, Letitia called to Sarah, waving goodbye and hurrying off to Amber. Perkins' flag was whipping loudly in the snowy wind. Well, said Sarah, as we both got into her car, that was for all intents and purposes a complete disaster. She started up the engine. You know, she continued, I always do the wrong thing. I do the wrong thing so much that the times I actually do the right thing stand out so brightly in my memory that I always forget I do the wrong thing. We rode mostly in silence, Sarah offering me gum, then cough drops, both of which I took, thanking her. When I glanced over at her driving without her sunglasses, her scarf wrapped now around her head like a babushka, she seemed watery, far away, lost in thought, and I wondered how a nice, attractive girl, for I thought I had glimpsed on the way up the girl I imagined she once was, her face still and thoughtful, her hair in the sun ablaze with light, how a girl like that became a lonely woman with a yarny schmata on her head, became this, whatever it was. After a childhood of hungering to be an adult, my hunger had passed. Unexpected fates had begun to catch my notice. These middle-aged women seemed very tired to me, as if hope had been wrung out of them and replaced with a deathly, walking sort of sleep. Sarah's cell phone played the beginning to Anna Kleinenacht music, its vigorous twang, not unlike a harpsichord at all. Sarah pulled the phone from her bag and slowed the car slightly while she did. "Excuse me," she said to me. "Yeah?" she said into the phone. All this despite the bumper sticker on her car that read, "Perhaps you would drive better with that cell phone shoved up your ass." She also had one that said, "If God speaks through burning bushes, let's burn bush and listen to what God says." It was interesting to me that such a woman, one with such rhetorical violence adhered to her car, had gotten past the adoption agency's screening processes, whatever they were. She also had a third bumper sticker that said, "Born fine the first time," though cell phones and Christianity were going to be the very things to bring her a child. Her fourth was no more promising. "Behind every successful woman is herself." I don't know why I could hear so clearly. Perhaps Sarah was a little deaf and had the volume on everything turned up high. "Sarah, hi, it's Letitia," I heard. "Hi, Letitia." I believed I wasn't supposed to listen, so I looked out the window at the bleak, snowy landscape. The sun was low and feeble, dissolving whitely like a lemon drop. Each town we passed through had a Dairy Queen with customers lined up even in winter. When I looked back at Sarah, I saw her powdered, thinning skin like a crepe, with the same light freckles as a crepe, her gnarly, knuckled hand, arthritic from chopping herbs, going through her spiky, russet hair, knocking back her scarf. How did her stand-up hair defy not just gravity, but even the additional weight of a scarf? Why did my own hair always lie flat, defeated by atmospheric physics of all sorts, unimproved even by the most widely advertised of sticky gels? Education had not entirely elevated my concerns in life. It had probably not even assisted my analyses of these concerns, though that was the most I could hope for. I was too fresh from childhood. Subconsciously, my deepest brain still a cupboard of fairy tales. I suppose I believed that if a pretty woman was no longer pretty, she had done something bad to deserve it. I had a young girl's belief that this kind of negative aging would never come to me. Death would come to me. I knew this from reading British poetry. But the drying, hunching, blanching, hobbling, fading, fattening, thinning, slowing, I would just not let that happen to moi. Sarah switched ears, making it harder for me to hear, but then switched back and slowed to let a convoy of trucks pass. I could hear Letitia. "If this doesn't work out with Amber, there are babies on the international market," Letitia was saying. "We've had a lot of luck with South America. Paraguay has opened up again, and other countries too, and they're not all brown either. There's been a lot of German influence, and some of these kids are beautiful, very blonde, or blue-eyed, or both." "Well, thanks for the info," said Sarah brusquely. "Get back to me on Amber." "Gotta run. There's an ice patch ahead," and she snapped the phone shut. "The babies of Nazis," Sarah said to me, shaking her head. "They're hawking Nazi babies, racially superior, unbelievable." She raked her fingers yet again through her bright desert grass of her the bright desert grass of her hair. I didn't ask her how a tiny baby could be a Nazi. What did I know? Maybe it could. "Blue eyes," she cried. "The human race has really come a long way. She shook her head again, this time with a horsey, nasal exhalation of disgust. You may be too young to know this yet, she said, but eventually you will look around and notice. Nazis always have the last laugh. And that's where I'm going to stop. I just put on my glasses and now I can see you. I'm not that good with technology, actually, in the hotel room. Just today I tried to talk on the hair dryer and dry my hair with a telephone. So, but there are people, I guess, with microphones. If you have questions, we can try to answer them. Yes, there's someone.
I loved this book, but I wanted to ask you on your short stories, People Like That Are the Only People Here, what kind of experience you must have had or research that you did to just so sensitively be able to talk about such a difficult topic as pediatric oncology.
Oh, and that's, you want to know what the autobiographical roots are?
If there are autobiographical, or if you research through friends or
you know, there
hospitals
are,
or what?
Okay. There are autobiographical roots to that story. I tend not to talk about those because that's, you know, if I wanted to write a nonfiction piece, I would have written a nonfiction piece. What I wanted to do was create a work of narrative art. And I was prompted by some things in my real life. But fiction writers, I think, are reluctant to sort of say, well, here's where everything came from, you know, because then it makes them feel like they're, you know, less of a magician than they would like to appear to be. But also, I think when you design and create a work of fiction, you're stepping away from an experience a little bit. You're stepping across a line into this invented land that holds a mirror up to real life. But the mirror is sort of warped and distorted and kind of a funhouse, not so funhouse mirror. And so you're working with a lot of invention and a lot of imagination, even if you are prompted by real life things. But in general, you know, I'm reluctant to talk about my son, and I'm sure you understand if you're a mom, and even if you're not a mom, I'm sure you understand. But there were some autobiographical things, yes, that prompted that. Thank you. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the title.
A Gate at the Stairs?
Yeah. Uh-huh. First of all, the cover of the book, which uh-huh. appears to be a staged stairs, the kind you'd see on a stage, that is. And then there are many passages in which you discuss something to do with gates and stairs.
Mm-hmm.
The baby gate, the baby fell down the stairs on page 251 especially, which seems to be a very climactic passage.
No, that's not an actual event. That's just a line.
Right. Oh, that, right. Yes, no,
right.
I wasn't
they think
implying
that.
That.
Just, you're right. It's not an actual event in the mouth. They just thought you'd ruin the book for them.
No.
No baby falls down the stairs in this book.
No.
So.
She's talking about the problem of being funny and about tragedy. On that page, anyway.
Right, on that page,
and
right.
And then there are other times when you mention gates to heaven. Mm-hmm. So I see connections there, but I'm trying to figure out all your connections.
Well, I found myself working it every which way. You know, a gate is a kind of barrier to ascension. It's also there can be a protective gate, as with a baby gate. But it also has a hinge. It comes open. There's a gate at heaven's door that you either pass through or not, you know, and that shows up in a song that Tassie, the narrator, writes. She's a kind of 20-year-old amateur musician, so she plays the bass guitar and writes really terrible poetry and terrible songs. I wonder who wrote those. At any rate, I had fun putting them in. And so it's a kind of motif and design that runs through the book. And it's meant to work every which way. And so I had the title already, and then I was looking when it came time to sort of, and the title was very boring, and nobody liked it. My publisher didn't really like it, and when people asked me what the title of my book was, I stopped saying it out loud. I said, "Oh, I'll tell you later," and things. It's a very boring title. But I knew that it had to be that. There's a gate when she first comes to the Thornwood Brinks. There's a gate right there that's kind of broken. And there's a gate at the farm where she grows up, where that opens to a path where she and her brother, you know, travel down and talk. And, you know, they have their sibling relationship alongside that. So there's gates throughout. And when it came time to choose the cover, I was looking at, for some reason, I was looking at the website of this photographer. And actually, I know the reason. I shouldn't say for some reason. It was Camille Vajnar, and I was looking at his website because he had done the cover of Sebastian Barry's Secret Scripture, and I was sort of enchanted by this kind of surreal photography, rather mannered but arranged stuff he was doing. He had a lot of people with wings, and suddenly in this website there was this picture of a field with a staircase in the middle, and this kind of either dawn or sunset kind of at the top, the light hitting in a certain way. I really recommend going to the website to get the actual color, because the colors are slightly different in the real photograph. The sky is very sort of almost pink rather than orange. At any rate, I love this photograph, and I thought this is destiny. You know, this belongs. You know, I felt it represented in a kind of surreal, symbolic, existential way. You know, almost everything I was trying to do with the idea of a gate at the stairs. And I thought we wouldn't get any better than this. And so I very enthusiastically sent it off to my editor and my publisher, and they were not that pleased. So several months of argument ensued. But in the end, they said, "Okay, we'll go with this." They had a cover that had crayons on it, which didn't please me. And they wanted crayons. Yeah, see, thank you for shaking your head. No, that's what I did. No. So, at any rate, that's a small abbreviated story of the cover and of the title. But there was someone right behind you. You're right there. Right, you don't need a mic.
Hi. I just wanted to first thank you because I love your books.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming.
I was wondering how you first knew you were a writer.
Oh, you never know. You never know. Even, you know, you probably go to your grave and wonder whether you've just lived the wrong life, you know. All you know is that you're writing, you know, that you're writing, you're doing your best, you're putting these, you know, stories together, and that you're very involved with making stories, both short and long. It's a great leap of faith. You hope that there are other readers who would be interested in a book that you're writing, and you're writing the book that you would be interested in as a reader, so you hope there are other people out there like yourself. And it's just a great leap of faith, and you never know if it's, you know, some grand cosmic joke being played on you or not. But, what, you know, you just keep doing it. If it's what you love, you know, if it's what you love, you do it. You have to find a way of supporting yourself while you do it. You can't ever count on it as being something that's going to pay the rent. But that's been the case for almost the entirety of history. I mean, there's been very few little periods where writers could make a living writing.
if you're making too much money, you might be doing something wrong, right?
No, you've just gotten lucky. You've just gotten lucky. I'm just saying you can't count on it, right? Because even people who make money, suddenly, you know, 10 years later, maybe they're not, you know, so it just can't be counted on. So it's, so in addition to writing, you have to also do something else, be something else. So to call yourself a writer and then expect the world to take care of you now because you are a writer, I feel that's a very dangerous thing to do. So, but just write your work, write the work that you love and just keep going. It will work out somehow. And if you, you know, if you're on your deathbed and said, oh, I should have been a painter, you know, you'll have a lot of company. Or I should have gone to medical school or whatever. You know, a lot of people are saying that. Especially on their deathbed. But yes.
After you hadn't published a book in about 11 years.
What?
Was it? Was that long? But now, are you, I mean, the other stuff was great too, but this book is so good. Do you feel like you're on a roll now? And is your I don't know, do you feel like
your
creative juices are going or something?
That's so kind of you to say. It makes me very worried because I'm not really on a roll. I'm on the road. You know, you never feel you're on a roll when you try to dry your hair with a telephone. So I don't know. You know, when I get through with I'm in this sort of, I'm in the part of the book tour that the publisher really shouldn't know about, which is where you start to turn on your own book and you start to say, don't buy this book, it's really not for everybody.
It's so good.
But eventually when I get, thank, that's so nice of you, when I get home next year, I'll be, yeah, I'm looking forward to writing stories and getting back to work. I have to say, I'm a little bit in mourning leaving this book because I kept company with Tassi Kelton for so long that I kind of miss her. And I do have some things waiting for me at the desk at home, but they're not her, you know, so I sort of, doesn't that sound demented to say, I miss this fictional character I invented. But it's true. But I'll eventually get involved with other ones.
Or maybe like Rabbit, she'll come back.
I don't know. I can't imagine that. But, you know, I suppose Updike didn't imagine that either when he first wrote the first one, which is very different from the others. But I don't know. I can't really imagine going back there. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
It's very exciting to see you in person. I'm a big fan of your work.
Thank you.
The first story verse that I read was Willing in Birds of America. And when I have a very precise question here. When I got to the passage that contained the lines, she'd been given a can of gravy and a hairbrush and told, there you go. She'd stood there for years, blinking and befuddled, brushing the can with the brush. I laughed out loud to that to myself for a good time, and I hadn't laughed like that in a while. And I wondered, the can of gravy and the hairbrush, was that in the first draft of that story? Were those the two objects that you paired?
That line was written for you. It was written just for you. Because I can't tell you how many people have complained about that line. But yes, it wasn't the first draft. I like that line too, but you and I are the only ones who understand that. So thank you.
I've read your other books as well, and I remember that line. It was really funny. I love the the epigraph to that book. I had forgotten how much I liked that. But I wanted to ask you a question about this book in comparison to Anagrams, which seemed to be like a very serious account of the themes of Anagrams in some ways to me. Like, it seemed to be about motherhood and young love and middle-aged love and race and the Midwest and a lot of things that I think you've written about in the past, but maybe not as, I don't know, scattershot isn't the word because that sounds like a critique, but it's a compliment. I guess I just want to know why all those themes, why in this book, why now? I don't know.
Well, I don't know that a writer really chooses her themes so much. I mean, you know, there's always the illusion that you are. But then once you finish the book, you realize, oh, this has in common this and this and this with my other novels. I did want in this book to have it be a completely Midwestern book, which is the thing that separates it from the other books, I think, which are not entirely that. And I wanted to scoop up everything I thought was sort of interesting and in transition about the Midwest right now. But it's true, there are things that recur in all my many novels. All three novels. All three novels have a protagonist who has turned her back in some kind of enchanted and infatuated way, has turned her back on a sibling who needs her. And in Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, the sibling actually hangs herself. In Anagrams, there's just a kind of troubled brother. And in this one, there's another brother. So I didn't realize that till I'd finished. You know, writers, sometimes writers are the last to know. You finish and you go, oh, clearly these are themes in my life. Well, let's move on to something else. Let's not think about that too much. So I don't know. You know, you write from what's inside you. You write from what you're interested in. If you write from anything else, you're not writing with the core of yourself. So obviously there's some things that are inside me that I keep returning to in different ways. But I really can't talk about it here without lying down. So, but thank you for noticing. I think we can take one more question, if there is one. There's one right, oh. You can ask me later.
Mine's a real short question, so maybe you could take two. I just wanted to know about the town that you're describing, Troy. I'm assuming, since I tried to Google both Troy and then the Indian German town, that they're fictional, because nothing, well, when I Googled the Indian German town, the chapter came up on Google from the book. So I'm assuming that they're fictional and it's representative of the University of Wisconsin. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I kind of, as with my last novel, I kind of wreaked havoc with the map. I don't say Wisconsin anywhere in this book, but I do say Green Bay. I do say Milwaukee. I make up a university town and call it Troy so I can have this weird joke and call it the Athens of the Midwest, which, you know, Madison calls itself, and actually Iowa City calls itself. So there are a number of cities in contention there. So it's a mix of invention and the actual map. And I think that just gave me some sense of freedom in writing, where I didn't have to actually check the mileage and make it completely accurate, because it's not. It's really not accurate. And the same was true in my last novel. People started to measure the distances between invented places and real places and got very confused. So I needed it to be a fictional place, but drawing on many, many real places in Wisconsin. So that's what it is. Yeah, most, I would say half the towns are made up and half of them are real. How confusing, but it made sense to me at the time when I was writing. One more question here. Did you want to?
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Thanks for coming. I was wondering, I'd like to get your personal thoughts about teaching, how conducive or complementary it is to your writing, if it's integral to how you write, and if you've been benefited by being in a university setting for the past few decades.
Oh, I should have quit while I was ahead. Thank you all for coming. Teaching comes out of a different muscle in your brain, and it's very, even though what I'm teaching is in theory writing, and we look at published contemporary work, and we talk about literature, and we care about semicolons and phrasing and syntax and all these things, it seems very separate from my life as a writer. And the one, I suppose, I mean, many people have asked me, since this character is 20 years old, she's in her late 20s narrating it, but she is 20 at the time of the storyline, and people have said, well, isn't this about your students, or weren't you inspired by your students, or were you inspired by one student? And I wasn't inspired by any particular individuals, and this doesn't represent any particular individual, but I do know from having worked with kids in their 20s that they're so smart. They're just really, really smart. And so in some ways, perhaps I was inspired to sort of, you know, have someone as bright as one of my students be the main character in a novel. It was a challenge to my sluggish middle-aged mind to try to, you know, be as smart as someone in their 20s, and I did my best. because they're very quick and amusing and observant, even if they're lacking in certain kinds of experiences, which of course come in life. But teaching is separate, and teaching is done, you know, for a number of, I mean, it's also a social event for me. You know, when you live your life as a writer, you're alone at a desk, you're a hermit. And then when you go to teach, you put on your little teacher outfit, and you are in a room full of highly verbal people, and you hold, you know, you have this intense conversation for 2.5 hours and read their work. And so it's, you know, teaching, I do like teaching, but it's very separate. Does that answer your question? You're kind of trying to wonder about the how they interfere.
Interferes one way to put it.
Or intersect.
That was a great answer. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.